Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business, and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome, welcome. Well, we have a fun show lined up for you today. Coming up around 12:30, we'll be talking with Lani Hall Alpert. She's a Grammy Award-winning vocalist, performer, lyricist, and she's now turned author. And, of course, she is the wife of Herb Alpert. And her new book is called Emotional Memoirs and Short Stories. This is her first book. And it has a psychological element running throughout the story, nonfiction and fiction and memoir. And I mention that because coming up first, this ties very nicely into our first guest, Dr. Guy Winch. His book is called Emotional First Aid. As many of you know, we have remedies for colds and physical ailments. We have a medicine cabinet probably full at home in our bathroom somewhere. And yet we often ignore emotional wounds. And Dr. Guy Winch specializes in this. His book is called Emotional First Aid, Practical Strategies for Treating Failure, Rejection, Guilt, and Other Everyday Psychological Injuries. And he's the author also of The Squeaky Wheel. He has a private practice in Manhattan where he helps patients learn to apply emotional first aid to their own lives. He's a member of the American Psychological Association and writes the Squeaky Wheel blog for Psychology Today. He is a clinical psychologist, and I'd like to welcome Dr. Guy Winch to the show.
Thank you so very much for having me.
Very pleased to have you. I think this is an important book. So it has a slightly different approach to it because you take each chapter, you've broken it down into the seven most common ailments, if you will, that we suffer psychologically, and broken it down into here's what it looks like and here's how we can treat it. But you're not offering, you know, Band-Aid fixes here. This is all based on sound research. It's based on journal papers. Tell us a little bit about the book in your own words, if you would.
Yes, well, I wrote it for that reason that you mentioned. You know, we get physical injuries like cuts and scrapes and sprains and colds all the time. And when we do, we know exactly what to do for them. We know how to treat them. We know how to make them better. And it struck me that when we get psychological injuries like rejection or loneliness or failure, which are injuries in that they injure us, they are wounds we sustain, they can last for a while, they can also get infected, quote unquote, and get worse. But we have no idea how to treat them. We have no idea in what way they're even impacting us. And there is this new line of research which looks at these common everyday things and has solutions and remedies for what exactly happening to us and what we can do about it, except no one really distilled that yet into some kind of book that people can follow, some kind of psychological medicine cabinet, if you will, they could just, you know, look to when they experience some of these things in their daily lives.
Right, and without reading a textbook, because it's very reader-friendly. And you talk about seven, you chose the seven most common psychological injuries. Share those with us, if you would, please.
I chose seven, by the way, also because I wanted to find things in which there is research that backs up these kinds of treatments. I didn't want to write something that just, oh, I think this would be good, but there's no research to show it.
Right.
So the seven I follow are rejection is the first chapter. Then there is loneliness. Then I talk about guilt and rumination and loss and trauma and failure and bouts of low self-esteem.
Hmm. And you go into quite a, I mean, I understood, I think I've experienced all of these as just about everybody has, but after reading the book, I have a deeper understanding of how these can impact us long term if we don't take the time to take care of them. One of the things I wanted to look at today was the chapter on loneliness. I read in the book that 27% of U.S. households are now single occupancy, single people. Which was shocking to me.
Right, you know, and that's the biggest category. In other words, that category of single-person household as opposed to, let's say, single-parent or multiple-family household is now the biggest category we have. And so living by yourself is a much, much more common thing than it used to be. And loneliness is a much more common thing. And it's so ironic because we keep talking about how the world is so much more connected. Mm-hmm. And we are in theory, but people can still experience profound loneliness. And by the way, they can experience that even if they're married and are living with a spouse. No guarantee, but it's a really common thing, loneliness. 40% of people are likely to experience it in some time as an adult, and it's very profound.
Yeah, I was talking about this with a group of friends who happen to be single and live alone by choice, and some of them looked at me as though I was crazy when I said, do you ever get lonely? Some people just don't get lonely. What's the difference between folks who do get lonely and people who don't get lonely? Is it just an intrinsic thing we're born with?
I think it depends on circumstance, and it depends on your psychology, and it depends on context. The definition really of lonely is not an objective one. It's your subjective experience. If you subjectively feel that you're isolated, either emotionally from someone or socially from people. In other words, you might be married but feel very alone and mm-hmm. emotionally isolated, or you might live in a circumstance, you might be disabled and have trouble with mobility, you might have moved to a new country, a new state, you started college. There can be all kinds of circumstances, but it's your subjective feeling that qualifies you to be lonely or not, not the actual quantity of your relationships and friendships and connections. You might have a lot of those, but still feel profoundly alone.
Yeah, let's go back to something you just said. You might be married, but still lonely. I think many of us have probably felt, I don't really feel lonely very often, but I do remember being in situations sometimes with other people and feeling alone. And so people can be married and feel lonely. What's going on there?
Well, usually what's going on there is that there's some kind of fundamental emotional disconnect in the marriage, and that can happen usually over time. It can happen quickly, more quickly to some than to others. But there are many marriages in which the people, even they themselves will say, well, we're kind of like roommates. But they're kind of like roommates, except they're not very good roommates, because even roommates usually communicate more than they might. They kind of go about their ways and they go about their lives, but in a very, very parallel way. They don't share their feelings. They don't share their thoughts and their hopes and their dreams. They just cohabitate. And that can leave you feeling excruciatingly alone, especially when there's somebody right there who you feel disconnected from.
Yeah, this is an interesting point, and I wanted you to just explain this if you would. You say in the book that loneliness is contagious, and specifically scientists found that lonely individuals were continually pushed toward the periphery of their social networks and into positions that increasingly isolated them even more. Why does that happen, and how?
Well, it's a very interesting thing with loneliness, because it does carry this big stigma. In other words, a lot of times, even in therapy, one of the last things they'll admit to is being lonely, because it does carry this kind of stigma. And when people are identified within a social network as a lonely person or as a loner, then people usually stay away from them for all kinds of reasons. And it has to do often with an interaction between that person and how they behave and how they present themselves. But it has this stigma. And that study found that it was contagious in that when they tracked social networks and they tracked people over time, they found that not only the lonely people got pushed to the periphery of the networks, had less qualitatively good relationships with the people within the networks, but people closest to them also got pushed out over time. In other words, there was a certain contagion effect where if you were associated with a lonely person, and again, for multiple kinds of reasons, then you also got marginalized over time to a certain degree within the social networks that they looked at. Because maybe you were picking up certain habits, maybe you were picking up the stigma in some kind of way, maybe you were starting to interact in a way that caused that. But it's a very, very interesting thing, because loneliness is a very difficult state to emerge from for this and other reasons.
Yeah. So I want to look at some of the behavior that causes that. But before we go into that, I wanted to look at some of the psychological wounds that you say loneliness can inflict. And just share a couple of the most common ones with us, if you would.
Well, one of the things that happens when people are feeling lonely is that they're feeling very raw emotionally and very risk averse. So they really are trying to protect themselves from getting hurt. And so they often will, you know, come up with these behaviors which they're justifying why they shouldn't do certain things, when in fact these are just excuses. So they'll explain, well, I got invited to the party, but I don't want to go because I won't really know anyone there and no one will want to talk to me. And so then even if they do go, they have a lot of self-defeating behaviors in that they go to the party, they expect no one will want to talk to them. So to be able to protect themselves from being rejected, they will actually stand on the periphery of the group. They'll, you know, park themselves by the hummus and the cheese dip and, you know, scowl all night because they're feeling isolated. But what they're putting out is a very, very unfriendly vibe. Also, lonely people tend to evaluate their friendships and their friends more negatively than they really should, and they're the closest that they have in reality. So they are likely to feel a little bit defensive and to act a little bit defensive and to say to someone, you know, I haven't spoken to you for 2 weeks, as opposed to, oh, how are you?
Right,
and that'll push people away, and it perpetuates this dynamic where they're nurturing their emotional wounds, but they're doing it in such a way that's actually pushing people away. And they're not aware of it. That's part of the problem with loneliness. They find excuses. They think it's the other person, because when they're responding this way, the other people respond to them, you know, in a certain way.
Right.
And then they go, oh, you see, they're not interested. They don't see their part in it some of the time.
Yeah, so it can almost come across as needy, because I do know somebody who will, if I have not talked with them for a month, will say, you haven't called me. And I'm thinking, well, you could have picked up the phone and called me, you know.
Right. And it's not very inviting when someone does that, but they're coming from a place of pain and they're coming from a place of really feeling bad, and that's what comes out. But it is very common that would happen.
Well, you share a lot of stories in the book, give a lot of anecdotes, which I think really help explain situations. And there was one example that kind of struck me. There was a woman in this chapter who was heavy her whole life. She said, men would look right past me as if I wasn't in the room. And trust me, I was hard to miss. Now they stare, they smile, they wink, and somehow it still feels the same as though they're looking right past her.
Yes, she was a very interesting person, because she had been heavy all her life, and then she lost weight, and she, you know, some people lose weight and they look much better. She lost weight and she looked absolutely stunning. And yet she carried with her this damaged self-esteem, these old habits from when she was heavy, from when she wasn't getting attention. And so she came across so defensively, and she came across with these habits which just didn't match what she looked like. And so these men would fall all over her, and then she started to feel, well, they're not even seeing me. Now they're thinking that I'm pretty, you know, in some way. So they're not really seeing the real me one way or the other. And so the way she would behave on these dates, she would really push these guys away. She would either be overly interested or she would be under interested. She had a really hard time catching the middle. And what I'd say about loneliness is that when we are in that situation, our relationship muscles, our social skills, those muscles that we tend to use, they get atrophied. Same thing is true if somebody just got divorced and they haven't been in the dating sphere and they start dating and it doesn't go well. Well, you haven't used those muscles for 20 years. They're not going to go that well right away. You have to work on it. You have to practice. You have to build up those muscles and regain your footing. You know, when we have the flu, we get wobbly when we come out of bed after a week, and we realize, yeah, our muscles got weak.
Right.
It's the same thing with loneliness. Our muscles get weak, and we have to strengthen them. And these are relationship muscles.
Mm. So we need to give ourselves a break, just as we would if we're recovering from a physical illness, ailment. So we're going to take a very quick break, Dr. Winch. When we come back, I want to look at how we can treat some of those psychological wounds inflicted by loneliness. And the name of Dr. Guy Winch's book is Emotional First Aid, Practical Strategies for Treating Failure, Rejection, Guilt, and Other Everyday Psychological Injuries. And you're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Please stay with us.
Yes, I'm in love. Who looks at you the way I do when you
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair with Conversations Live. If you'd like to gain more exposure for your business, service, or event, or if you'd like to raise awareness for an issue or topic you're passionate about, call me. Let's talk about ways we might partner to shine the spotlight on you and bring you the recognition you deserve. Call me at 800-495-7617. That's 800-495-7617.
At Sundown Communications, we find that most of our clients are brilliant at what they do, but they lack the time and resources to write and create business messaging that delivers results. That's where we come in, providing a diverse range of professional copywriting services for fresh strategic web content, PR, advertising and promotion, marketing, speeches, and much more. Call us today so you can focus on what you do best, and we'll do the rest. Call 800-495-7617. That's 800-495-7617.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicky St. Clair.
Radio for your body, mind, and spirit. Alternative Talk, 1150.
And welcome back, everybody. You are listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, and my guest in this segment is Dr. Guy Winch. He's a clinical psychologist, the author of The Squeaky Wheel, and his new book is called Emotional First Aid: Practical Strategies for Treating Failure, Rejection, Guilt, and Other Everyday Psychological Injuries. So we've talked about the importance of spending as much time healing our emotional wounds as we would our physical ones, with in particular looking at loneliness in this segment. And I want to now look at how we can treat some of those psychological wounds that loneliness can inflict upon us. And there are many. So where do you say somebody needs to start? And obviously everybody's different, but most commonly, where should somebody start?
Well, I think the place for someone to start, and this is actually regarding every single one of the wounds I discuss in the book, is that you have to start with a basic acceptance of that when certain experiences happen to you, when certain events happen, you actually have to expect that there was a psychological wound there. You know, when you wipe out off a skateboard or your bike, first thing you'll do is check yourself to see, ooh, did something happen to me? Did I break something? Did I sprain something? Well, that's the habit we should get in when we experience severe rejections or failures, or when we're feeling lonely for an extended amount of time. We should first of all check ourselves and accept that we're probably psychologically wounded in some way, and then just look to see, well, how, first of all, in what ways are we wounded, and what can we do about it? But that basic acceptance is not an obvious thing. People argue with me about it all the time, and some people literally say to me things like, yeah, well, you know, I don't have those kinds of feelings. And I'm like, well, that's just not possible. You know, you might not have a lot of them. You might be a sting rather than a real pain, but you have feelings. We're emotional beings. It's not possible you don't. And then they'll say, okay, well, maybe a little bit. So you have to be brave about it, and in no case more so than with loneliness, because you have to accept that if you've been lonely for a chronic amount of time, there are probably habits that you've developed that you're not aware of that are not serving you. And that's a very hard thing for some people to accept. You have to start there by having an open mind and accepting that you need to examine your behavior and find the patterns that are not serving you, even if you feel justified in them, but the patterns, the excuses you make that you've made many times to not engage in things, and you have to be willing to open your eyes and see things in a different way.
Yeah, I think one of the things I remember from early on in my career was I used to work with a lot of women. We only had women clients, and so they're pretty open talking amongst themselves, you know, when there's no men around. And, you know, one of the things that I remember my mom saying to me, because I worked with her, was, you know, gosh, there are some people that you just don't want to be around because they're so draining. And, mm-hmm. and you know, people can be draining or energizing. And I think sometimes, like you just said, people don't realize they've picked up those habits that can be draining on other people.
It can. I mean, I'll just give you one. I did this radio interview a couple of weeks ago, mm-hmm. and they were taking questions from the site, from the radio station's Facebook page, live. And one of the questions was, well, I have a lot of loneliness, and I just don't have any options to connect with people who feel like me. But the person left that on the station's Facebook page, along with many other comments from listeners who actually did feel just like him. And it's Facebook, so there was his name and there was their name. He could have actually reached out to any single one of them. Mm-hmm. It was just very marked because, well, there, right there, you have an option which you're not seeing. As you know, and your question got on the air. You can actually say, if there's anyone there who wants to talk to me, please. You know, in other words, we do have these options, but we have to open our eyes and be willing to you know, set aside some of our assumptions and really see what we can do to better ourselves.
Right. You gave a great example in the book, too, about the kid who was at college and he was a sports fanatic and, you know, could talk the hind leg off a donkey about sports. And share that story with us, if you would. Was a great story of connection, too.
Yes, well, that was someone who had a certain disability, and it was a physical one, and it was an apparent one, and so he really was shunned for most of his life. He was, you know, called all kinds of names based on his disability, but he had a profound interest in sports, and he was very knowledgeable and actually very smart about it. And when he started talking to people around him about sports, then within time they just started to connect with him about sports. And his greatest moment, where he was late one day to class and he heard people saying, "Where's that Yankees guy?" And he was never known as the Yankees guy. He was only known as the guy with this disability or some bad name after another. And to him it was like, wow, I'm the Yankees guy. They're not talking about my disabilities. And it was very successful for him to connect in his area of strength, which is one of the strategies we should all use.
Right. One of the things that I want to point this out, you say in the book that, you know, many people can be really helped by reading this book. There may be other people who actually need to go and seek counseling or advice from a psychologist. Tell us how and when we can differentiate between the two.
Well, much like any kind of first aid situation, I mean, when it comes to a physical situation, you'll get a sprain, you know, you'll ice it, you'll be careful with it. But if it doesn't get better, you'll know you should go to a doctor. And when you get a cut, you can pretty much tell whether you might need stitches or not and which you can take care of. We don't have that sophistication yet when it comes to psychological injuries. So at the end of each chapter, I give very clear guidelines for, well, if this happens or if this is what you're feeling or if this is what's going on, then you should actually consult a mental health professional. And of course, one of the first things I say is, if you've done all these things and it's not working, by all means go and speak to someone. But the truth is that a very small minority of people in the population in general can have the means, have the options, have the ability to go and see a mental health professional. We serve a very small number of people. And so I wanted to give people a tool that they don't need to go and pay a lot of money or go on waiting lists or make appointments 3 weeks down the road when they're hurting. Something they can do right away, something they can offer a friend if a friend is hurting, something, in fact, that they can teach their children. Because I think almost everything in the book, all the techniques I suggest, are things we can and should teach children. And so the idea is, let's take care of these, of the things we can take care of ourselves. And a lot of times we won't need to go to the mental health professional because things won't develop if we're actually tackling them in the moment and making sure we're okay in the moment.
Yeah. This was a fascinating line here, and I wanted to just share this with our listeners, because often, you know, we can be lonely because we've been rejected and we're fearful of getting that rejection again. You say that rejection activates the same pathways in the brain as when we experience physical pain. So there is that really, you know, we do feel that pain. But you say the brain operates in such the same way that giving people Tylenol before asking them to recall a painful rejection eased the pain they felt. I found that fascinating.
Well, it was fascinating to the scientists when they found that out, because they were really looking at why rejection, for example, seems to hurt, even if we don't really care that much about the people who rejected us. We'll sometimes find out we weren't invited to a party of people we kind of don't really like that much, and we'll still feel upset. Our feelings
right.
will still hurt, even though, well, we don't actually like those people and probably wouldn't want to go. And so scientists were curious about, well, why does rejection hurt in such situations in which it doesn't really matter or we don't care, you know? And so when they put people through functional MRIs, with the brain scan where you can actually see what's happening to a person while they're thinking or doing something particular. And what they did in this one experiment is they had people come in who had experienced a very painful romantic rejection, and they had them actually look at the picture of the person who rejected them and relive that rejection while they were in the fMRI machine. And by the way, yes, they got well compensated, because I did find that out. They did. I wondered, how much did they get for that? They should get money for that. They did. But anyway, what they found was that the same areas of the brain light up when people experience physical pain, because those pathways really piggyback on the rejection pathways, on the physical pain pathways. And then the follow-up was, well, let's see what happens if we give them Tylenol. And lo and behold, people reported less emotional pain when they went through the experiments in which they got rejected. And so that's why rejection is so painful. And that's why when people say to me, oh, I don't have those feelings, I'm like, well, kind of, yes, you do. We're all wired that way. You might have them to a lesser extent than some other people, but you're not completely a robot. You have feelings.
Yeah, I think understanding is half the battle. And this is a great book, Emotional First Aid. It covers the 7 most common psychological wounds and how to get over them, and great advice in here. Much needed book, I think. Thank you, Dr. Guy Winch, for being with us. Appreciate your time.
Thank you so very much for having me.
And would you please just give out your website quickly to listeners, because I know they can find your blog articles and more information from there.
Yes, they can find a lot of information. It's guywinch.com. That's GUYWINCH.com. You'll find links to lots of other articles I've written on the topic and lots of advice. And you can sign up for my mailing list and get an article about how to deal with rejection and lots of information.
Super. Thank you so much. Thanks.
Thank you. Bye-bye now.
And we're going to take a very quick break. When we come back, we'll be joined by Grammy Award-winning vocalist Lani Hall-Alpert, who has written a new book called Emotional Memoirs and Short Stories. Please do stay with us. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. This is Vicky St. Clair with Conversations Live. If you'd like to gain more exposure for your business, service, or event, or if you'd like to raise awareness for an issue or topic you're passionate about, call me. Let's talk about ways we might partner to shine the spotlight on you and bring you the recognition you deserve. Call me at 800-495-7617. That's 800-495-7617. 7617.
This is Martha Norwalk. Every Sunday morning, beginning at 9 a.m., thanks in part to New Pro Supplements, we cover the world of animals. This week, October 20th, it's a Kevin and Kim Sunday. Kevin McDonald and Kim Miller Medium and Animal Intuitive will host the show for me. They'll start with an interview with Jude and Paul Potten from Whispering Dragon. Then they'll have open phone lines so Kim can help you connect with your animal or human loved ones on this side or the other. Martha Norwalk's Animal World, Sunday morning, 9 a.m. to noon, right here on Alternative Talk. AM 1150.
OMG! Grammar abuse is no LOL! Hire a copywriter today and make sure your business communications rise above the crowd and deliver the results you need. Call 800-495-7617 today. BTW, IMHO, copywriters rule. Call 800-495-7617. BFN!
Do you love wildlife? Then make a real difference by helping PAWS care for sick and injured wild animals. Volunteers help feed and clean the animals until they are well enough to return to the wild. Sign up today and help save a wild life. No experience necessary. All training is provided. Visit PAWS.org or call 425-787-2500.
Next week on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, a new Gallup poll found that only 13% of employees feel engaged at work. If you're among the other 87%, leadership consultant and career coach Bud Bilenick joins us with tips on how to fall back in love with our work and get life on track. Find guest details and more than 300 free podcasts at conversationslive.net.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Making a difference, one word at a time.
Alternative Talk 1150 is on the interwebs. Dial us up at 1150kknw.com.
Never say never again. Never, never say never again. Thank you.
nothing I've ever known. But from all that I hear, forget about long range plans, 'cause this man's got his own. To get mixed up with a man who says never, maybe big trouble.
Wow. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, and that was my next guest singing Never on the James Bond film. And her name, of course, is Lani Hall Alpert, and I'm very pleased to have her with us today. She's written a great new book. It's called Emotional Memoirs and Short Stories. It's a mix of narrative, fiction, and nonfiction. And let me tell you a little bit about Lani. She was born and raised in Chicago. She became a professional vocalist and lyricist at 19, traveled the world as a performer, initially as a lead singer with Sergio Mendes and Brazil 66. She recorded 12 albums in English, Spanish and Portuguese, and sang the title song for the James Bond film Never Say Never Again, which featured in, I think that was Sean Connery's last film as James Bond. In 1985, she won a Grammy Award for her Latin CD and continues to record with her husband, the legendary Herb Alpert. And she's just written her very first book, Emotional Memoirs and Short Stories. Lani Hall Alpert, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Vicky. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, it's a pleasure to be to talk with you. And your voice, my God, through my headphones was just fantastic, just incredible. It sent chills down
thank
me.
Thank you. That's a great song, though. I mean, especially that first line, you walk in a room, a woman can feel the heat. You know, that's such a great line.
Right, right. Well, let's just share a little bit more about your background, Lani, and then I want to talk about some of the stories in the book, because you've literally taken your passion for music, and everything I've read about you describes you as a very passionate, very sensitive woman, and you've taken all of that and poured it into this book, which I understood took 30 years to write. Is that right?
Yes, it is. Yes, I actually wasn't planning on writing a book. You know, I've written all my life, and I started writing short stories in the early 80s, and I would just write them and put them in a drawer when I thought I was finished with them, and I was, you know, happy just to do that, and I collected quite a few over the years. And a friend of mine was recovering from a surgery that she had, and she was, you know, like losing her mind while she was sitting at home, just sick of television, sick of everything. And I said, well, you know, I wrote a story that about me being sick. Maybe it'll pick you up a little bit. And I sent it to her, and she was so encouraging that I decided to look at all these stories that I've written and see what maybe I should put them together. Maybe they'll mean something.
Yeah. Well, and I think they do. A lot of living there, a lot of experience and wisdom. You know, it's very unusual to see narrative and fiction and nonfiction in the same book. Why did you choose to do it that way?
Well, I think it has to do with just making so many albums in my career, record albums, and wanting some type of continuity inside that music, that it isn't just jumping from one style to another, so that the listener is kind of jumping along with it. I wanted something to tie it together, and then I thought of the same idea for the book. I kind of looked at these 10 short stories as songs and wanted to tie them together some way. And because they're a mixture of fiction and nonfiction, I had written, during the years, I had written this emotional memoir. And I took from that and started placing them in front of each story so that there was a through line from the beginning of the book to the end of the book.
Right. And so just to explain to listeners, you have an emotional recall, you're remembering something, and then you write a story to follow that, and that story may be nonfiction, it may be about you, or it may be a totally fictitious story.
Right.
Yeah. I love what Lou Adler said on the back of your book. Your first book is as freeform as a jazz piece, weaving in and out of intriguing situations and indelible characters. She writes as she sings with emotion and passion. So I'm curious, because I also read that you, when you were younger, at home, living at home as a teenager, you loved to sing, but nobody knew you sang other than your parents, and you would listen to all these female artists. And is that where your passion for singing developed?
I think I was born with a passion for singing. I know that when I was very small, when I just started speaking, I would sing along with songs on the radio. So I think that my natural gift was music and singing and feeling the lyric of a song. So when I was, and I didn't need an audience to do that. I could just go in my room and play the albums that I loved and sing along with them and feel really satisfied. And I learned so much from these singers that I sang with, you know, June Christie. I sang with a lot of jazz singers.
Mm-hmm.
So I was singing with June Christie and Anita O'Day and Lambert Hendricks and Ross and Frank Sinatra. And then when Barbra Streisand came out, you know, I was so enamored with those arrangements and the power and the beauty of her voice and the drama. And so I really just connected with that art form.
Right.
And while I was singing in Chicago in my room, I was also writing poetry, and I was writing a lot of my impressions and things. So when I joined Brazil 66 when I was 19, Sergio Mendes read a few of my poems, because he'd see me on the road writing, and he'd ask me what was I doing, and I'd show him a poem, and he said, "Do you think you could put this words to music?" And I said, "Well, I've never really done that, but I could try." And that's when I started writing lyrics to a lot of the Brazilian songs that we were doing. I started writing English lyrics to it.
Right. What a great start.
Yes.
But you didn't go straight into music, right? As I understood, you left home at like 18. You left Chicago at 18, right?
I left Chicago at 19 with Sergio.
Okay.
With the group that he had put together, the new group that he put together called Brazil 66.
Okay. And so then, where did that take you? What was the next leg of your journey?
The next leg of my journey was, listening and learning about the music that I was singing, which was Brazilian music, and I really fell head over heels in love with that music. I really followed the music the rest of my life, really. That's pretty much what I ended up doing as a professional singer. I followed the music that moved me the most, and because of my singing in my room with all these jazz musicians, Brazilian music has a lot of jazz in it. So I felt very comfortable with it. And I picked up the accent really easily for some reason. I mean, I hadn't been exposed to that, but I picked it up. And I was singing it like more or less like a native.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved singing in Portuguese. I still do to this day. And so that's what in most of my albums as solo artist, I always put something in Portuguese in my album. And I've done two albums in Portuguese for the Brazilian market as well.
Right. I remember singing into my hairbrush when I was younger in foreign accents. No, I didn't end up winning a Grammy. But, you know, all of this life experience that you've gained on the road and with your music and in your, what is it, 40 years now you've been with your husband?
Well, actually, we're going to be celebrating our 40th wedding anniversary in December, but we've been together for 44 years.
That is awesome. I mean, it's quite a love story.
Great?
I know. I told our producer, Lonnie, before the show, I said, you know, I was looking for pictures of Lonnie to put on the Facebook page, and And every single picture of you and your husband, Herb Albert, together, just there's such a connection between you. You're not posing. You're really leaning into one another. There's a sense of intimacy there. You just look like the best of friends.
We are.
Yeah.
We are the best of friends. Well, absolutely.
I want to share with listeners what you wrote in the book. We're going to take a quick break and we'll listen to some of your music. But when we come back, I want to share what you wrote about him in your book when we come back. And then look at some of the stories that you've written here, because there's some really interesting psychological aspects to the story. And you're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And my guest in this segment is Lani Hall Alpert. She's the author of emotional memoirs and short stories. Please do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Why are my eyes always full of this vision of you? Why do I dream silly dreams that will never come true? I want to show you the stars caught in the dark of the sea. I want to speak of my love, but he won't come to me. So I go on asking if someday you will care. I tell my sad little dreams to the soft evening air. I'm quite hopeless, it seems. Two things I know how to do. One is to dream.
Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair with Conversations Live. If you'd like to gain more exposure for your business, service, or event, or if you'd like to raise awareness for an issue or topic you're passionate about, call me. Let's talk about ways we might partner to shine the spotlight on you and bring you the recognition you deserve. Call me at 800-495-7617. That's 800-495-7617.
If you love dogs, tune in to The Dog Show with Julie Forbes live every Wednesday from 2 to 3 p.m. We'll talk about everything dog and interview authors, experts, and amazing organizations both locally and nationally. And don't even get me started on the pet food industry. I'm Julie Forbes. Find us online at www.dogradioshow.com and also as a free podcast on iTunes. The Dog Show with Julie Forbes, an evolved perspective on life with dogs.
Next week on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, a new Gallup poll found that only 13% of employees feel engaged at work. If you're among the other 87%, leadership consultant and career coach Bud Bilenick joins us with tips on how to fall back in love with our work and get life on track. Find guest details and more than 300 free podcasts at conversationslive.net.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Listen to podcasts of past shows at conversationslive.net.
You're listening to Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back. Welcome back. We are talking with Lani Hall Alpert. She, of course, is the Grammy award-winning vocalist, performer, lyricist, and she's now an author of emotional memoirs and short stories. And this is a book that's based on narrative, nonfiction, and fiction. And it's very unusual, Lani, to get short stories today that... So it was great to see this mix. As you said earlier, you kind of saw each piece as a song. And so I want to share with listeners that you've been married almost 40 years. You just said that before we went to break. And I asked you in the break, what are you going to do to celebrate? And you said, just be together. And I thought that was just awesome. You said in the back of your book, where is home? Mine is my husband's arms. You sometimes miss Chicago, but there's no doubt that your husband's arms are home. Tell us about that.
Well, that's where home is for me. Wherever he is, I'm home. So, and when I'm in his arms, that's everything for me.
Mm-hmm.
So, just encompasses everything that I feel safe, I feel comfortable, I feel myself, I feel accepted, understood, and I'm holding love in my arms.
Right.
While he's holding me, it's a pure moment.
Yeah, and I'm sure he does too. Do you have a favorite story in this book?
You know, there's so many different aspects to the characters in the book that I pulse to the ones that are factual, you know, to my life, and all the emotional memoir pages. The narrative is all nonfiction as well, and there are three nonfiction stories in the book. But I feel for the characters that are in the fictionalized stories as well. And there's part of my life is in those stories. Like, for example, there's the second story is called Standing Appointment, and it's about bad therapy.
Right.
And the girl in the character in the story is very lost and is teetering on her with her sanity, and it's based all around dreams. All the dreams are mine. All the dreams. That's how I started writing the story. Actually, I woke up with the dream that it opens with, and I just kept going. I kept writing, and all of a sudden, I found myself speaking to an analyst, and then I just kept going with that idea. But all the dreams are mine, so that part of it is from my life, but the rest of it isn't. So
right, and there are in the fiction stories. I mean, you cover things like, you know, making a choice between a stranger and a distant husband. You talk about the psychotherapist.
Mr. Belmont.
Yes.
That's the romantic story.
Well, share that with us. That obviously makes you chuckle. So share that one with us.
Well, Mr. Belmont, you know, because I'm from Chicago and there's a where you change trains to go from the regular elevated train to the subway. Is Belmont. That's where I had to change trains. And every morning I would see this guy. I was like maybe 17. And I would see this guy sitting on this bench waiting for the train. And he had a suit on and shine shoes. And his attaché case was sitting by his shoes. And then he would get on the train. And I would just like, you know, look at him. And I called him Mr. Belmont. Because it was Belmont Station.
There you go.
And he said hello to me once, I think. I'm not exactly. I think he said hello to me. And so I just decided to, Mr. Belmont is really it's kind of my Valentine to Chicago. It's very descriptive of Chicago and my memory of it, and the especially with the L trains and the buildings and the light and the sky and the weather and just how romantic it was and the wind. And so that's my kind of my Valentine to Chicago. And that's the romance that she has.
Right.
That she almost has.
She almost has. Yeah. In her dreams. I had one of those too. So you mentioned your brother a couple of times throughout the book. Obviously, you were very close growing up, and I know you say that you did miss him leaving Chicago. Talk to us a little bit about the relationship with your brother.
Well, my brother and I were not close for, I would say, the first 14 years of my life. And when he left, when I was 14 years old, he left to join the Air Force because he was 4 years older than me. And when he was in the Air Force, something happened to him that he started writing me all these wonderful letters and wanting to connect with me all of a sudden. and telling me that there's, you know, we have the same blood running through our bodies, and we're there for each other. We need to be there for each other. And so I was skeptical at first, but when he came home from the Air Force 4 years later, I was 18 and he was 22. And, I just, you know, we were inseparable. I mean, you know, we just went everywhere together, and I was so happy that I had this brother that I could count on and mm-hmm. depend on, and that, you know, and he was proud that I was his sister. And so we've had, a very close relationship all our lives.
Yeah.
He's here in Southern California, and we see each other quite often, and we talk a lot on the phone. And he's my big brother.
Yeah, and I think that's awesome to have that relationship. That's a gift in itself, too. You say yeah. in the book, that in the narrative, that you are from I am from my parents, and not to love them would mean that I don't love all of who I am, because they are part of the whole of who I am. How could I ever forgive myself if I never forgave them? Talk to us a little bit about the relationship with your parents, if you would.
Yeah, that's the emotional memoir page from the nonfiction story Confrontation. I had a very I came from a very volatile home. And the decibel level was very high, and my mother, God bless her, she had a hard time. She was emotionally and mentally unstable, and it frightened me a lot, and it frightened my brother, and we all did the best we could, given our set of circumstances, but I didn't really understand that kind of energy.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't understand it. And so I spent a lot of my young adulthood just trying to get away from it. And at one point, I had just come out of the hospital with a pain that I was having in my side, and a doctor said to me, you know, this could be from internalized anger, you know, and suddenly I said, oh, my God, you know,
right.
I don't want to have all these physical symptoms because I'm hanging on to something that I shouldn't be hanging on to. And so I went to my parents and I talked to them about it and I confronted them.
Right.
And it was a breakthrough moment for me because, I saw how vulnerable my mother was, and I think I really got it at that moment, how lost she was, and how I think my empathy kicked in,
mm-hmm.
and suddenly I wasn't angry anymore. I kind of understood how lost she was, and I was sorry that we all didn't know that and that we couldn't help her more.
Well, is this one of the reasons that in the book I'd mentioned, and we only have like 30 seconds left here, Alani, but in the book I'd mentioned that there is a psychological element running through the book with some of the characters, and yet there's always that little glimmer of hope there in the darkness.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. I think that's what darkness is for, so that you could break through to the light.
Yeah.
And that's what every character in the book has to face. These women are looking for themselves. They're redefining who they are because they've changed, and they haven't caught up with that change yet. And so they're challenged, and that's what a lot of the stories are facing.
Yeah. Well, if you could sum this up in like 20 seconds, what do you know now about life, about yourself, that you wish you'd known 30 years ago? Big question.
I wish I wouldn't have taken everything so seriously, so personally.
Great. Yeah, I love that. That's actually my aim right now. That's a great note to end the show on.
Jump on the train. There's a lot of us on this train.
Lani Hall-Alpert, you are such a delight to talk with. The book is called Emotional Memoirs and Short Stories, and you've got a fabulous website. Would you give us your website so listeners can... I go check that out too.
It's LaniHall.com.
There we go. Thank you so much for being with us today. Really appreciate it.
And Vicky, it's been my pleasure.
And you can find out more at the website that Lani just gave out. If you missed any of that, you can find us at conversationslive.net. And you can also reach us at 800-495-7617, 800-495-7617. We'll be back next week. Until then, live well, live strong. Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.